You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 120, More Terrible Than Ever. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by thanking our Patreon supporters. As for the rest of you, I hope you'll consider joining us. Not only will you get ad-free versions of the regular episodes, you'll get access to our bonus episodes. The most recent installment included discussions of women in Napoleonic armies and post-traumatic stress disorder among soldiers of this era. Just $2 a month gets you access to all 29 installments, plus the ad-free episodes, and it's the single best way to support the show. And as we are coming up on the holiday season, I'll remind you that Patreon now allows you to buy gift subscriptions for other people. So if you know someone who is a fan of the show and doesn't have the resources to subscribe, it's something to think about. This project would not be viable if it was supported solely by ad revenue. Thank you to those of you who have chipped in. You're the ones making all this possible. Anyway. We left off last time in early 1809. Napoleon had just returned to the capital after a short stint on campaign in Iberia. The fighting there was far from over, but the emperor was needed elsewhere. With the French distracted in Iberia, to the east, the Habsburgs were preparing for another war. Back in Paris, some sections of the ruling elite were becoming alienated from Bonaparte, put off by the catastrophic failure of his policies in Spain, and more generally by the relentlessly aggressive foreign policy he had pursued since the Treaty of Tilsit. Napoleon saw this as disloyalty and aimed to nip it in the bud by making an example of Talleyrand, which failed spectacularly when he completely lost his temper in front of most of the empire's civilian leadership. Bonaparte was frustrated, not only at the wavering politicians, but at the generals who he felt had let him down in Spain, at his Russian allies, whose support was not as forthcoming as he'd imagined a year and a half earlier, and at the Habsburgs, who remained unwilling to accept the new order he was trying to build. And I think he was also frustrated at the general strategic situation. Not so long ago, a total victory had seemed relatively close at hand. After Tilsit, Bonaparte had believed it was just a matter of making a few minor adjustments to the European order, then everything would fall into place. Europe would settle into a new status quo under French hegemony. It had all seemed so clear, practically inevitable. That vision had unraveled very quickly. France's strategic position was still quite strong, but the path to the final victory no longer seemed as short and clear as it had 18 months earlier. Now the empire was bracing itself for war on multiple fronts. Napoleon would be facing a rejuvenated Austrian military. As we discussed last episode, the brother of the Habsburg Emperor, Archduke Charles, had finally been given free rein to pursue an agenda of military reform. The Habsburg forces had been almost totally reconstructed, most significantly with modern French-style doctrines and systems of organization. Their French opponents would be different too. In fact, for the first time in all the wars we've covered between these two countries, many of the soldiers mobilizing to face the Habsburgs were not French at all. The imperial forces in Central Europe included perhaps as many as 100,000 Germans. To the east, on the Galician front, practically all the forces on the Napoleonic side would be Polish. On the Italian front, they would be largely Italian, although led by mostly French officers. There would be Dutch, Flemish, Swiss, and even a few Irish troops in the mix as well. The Austrian army had always been very international. Remember, these were the armed forces of all the Habsburg realms, which stretched across much of Central and Southeastern Europe. The Habsburg ranks included large numbers of Hungarians, Czechs, Croats, Slovaks, Slovenes, and others, alongside German-speaking Austrians. We generally think of the Italians and the Poles as fighting on Napoleon's side, but there were a great many to be found in the Habsburg ranks as well. From a certain perspective, this almost looks more like some kind of pan-European civil war than a conflict between two countries. The Austrian military would be entering the conflict with a lot of unanswered questions. Had the Archduke's reforms made the army more effective? And had they truly taken root, or would the old conservative officer corps return to old habits under the stress of wartime? There were unanswered questions around Napoleon's forces as well. Would the emperor's methods still be effective with so many less trained, less experienced, and non-French soldiers in the ranks? Did Napoleon's charisma translate to all these foreign troops, or was he only capable of inspiring his own countrymen? By this point in our story, everyone knew these questions would soon be answered on the battlefield. It was obvious the Austrians would not launch major offensives in Central Europe in winter, but the whole continent expected war to come with the spring thaw. In Vienna, there was hot debate as the Habsburg leadership finalized their plans. Archduke Charles wanted to make the main thrust northwards, from Bohemia into the heart of Germany. If successful, they might cut Napoleon's empire in two, leaving him unable to reinforce or support his allies in the east. Cut off from France, with Austrian forces on their doorstep, perhaps some of Napoleon's less enthusiastic German allies might switch sides. As we discussed last episode, the Austrians were hoping their attack on France would provoke an uprising among Bonaparte's German subjects. French rule was weaker and less popular in central and eastern Germany than it was in the south and west. The Austrians would have a much better chance of realizing these hopes for an anti-French uprising if they sent their armies into the areas that were likeliest to rebel. Of course, there was a big obvious drawback to the idea of making the main thrust to the north. Paris was to the west. Even if this campaign succeeded completely, it would not be a killing blow. In fact, it wouldn't do much to damage France's core national interests. And so, others in the Habsburg leadership favored a more direct approach, making the main thrust due west, through southern Germany, towards the Rhine, and France. If successful, this type of campaign could become an existential danger to Napoleon very quickly. With France already embroiled in the war in Iberia and members of Bonaparte's own government increasingly dissatisfied, who could predict what might happen if a victorious Habsburg army crossed into French territory? Perhaps the whole regime might collapse. However, this strategy also had a big drawback. If the Austrians made their main thrust through southern Germany, they would be very unlikely to be welcomed as liberators. The South German states of Baden, Württemberg, and Bavaria were all quite friendly with France. The French had not imposed their rule on this part of Germany. These governments had all willingly allied themselves with Bonaparte, in large part because they had wanted to get out from under the influence of the Habsburgs. Particularly in Bavaria, the period of Austrian hegemony over Germany was not remembered fondly. All three countries had benefited from their alliance with France. In Bavaria's case, they had actually been given a significant chunk of territory at Austria's expense, which the Habsburgs would certainly want back if they won the war. To many people in southern Germany, the menacing, arrogant enemy was Austria, not France. They might not have loved Napoleon, but he had helped them modernize their armies and administrations, elevated their monarchs to the status of kings, and gotten them out from under the Habsburg boot heel. Many average people in southern Germany approved of the French, or at least had ambivalent feelings about their presence. Generally speaking, this area was not some hotbed of rebellion, just waiting for the spark of an Austrian invasion. Baden, Württemberg, and Bavaria all stood to lose a lot if the Habsburgs were victorious. They would likely fight hard to prevent that outcome. In the end, Archduke Charles was overruled, and Austria adopted this plan for a westward thrust into southern Germany towards France and the Rhine. The Austrians would put most of their forces into this offensive, and it would be led by Archduke Charles, despite his opposition to the plan. It would be supported by secondary offensives. Another Habsburg army would invade Poland, aiming to knock Napoleon's most important eastern ally, the Grand Duchy of Warsaw, out of the war. Another army would push into French-controlled northern Italy. Once again, the Po Valley would become a battleground. We will be covering those secondary fronts, but for now, just like the combatants themselves, we will be focusing on the main Habsburg offensive, Archduke Charles's push to the west into southern Germany. Once the fighting broke out, the Austrians would find they had underestimated French strength. They believed the opposing field armies would number just under 200,000 men. In fact, the emperor had managed to pull together about 300,000. Many of the marshals we have come to know over the course of this show were still in Spain, and would not play any role in this new war. But Napoleon had left several of his best commanders in Central Europe, and the French army had an abundance of capable leaders. The vaunted Third Corps of the Grande Armée, which had won so much glory holding off the Prussians at Auerstedt, had remained in Germany. It was still led by Marshal Louis-Nicolas de Vaux, arguably the best French commander after Napoleon himself. They would play a major role in the campaign to come. Marshal François Lefebvre, who we last saw taking the fortress city of Danzig, had been placed in command of the Bavarian military, which would effectively operate as a core of Napoleon's army, and would be the first to face the Austrians. Second Corps would be led by General Nicolas Oudinot. Oudinot was not a marshal, but had distinguished himself in the recent campaign in Poland and Eastern Prussia. He had been particularly instrumental at the Battle of Friedland, holding the line in those first few desperate hours. He had certainly earned the opportunity to lead an entire corps. Our old friend from the First Italian Campaign, Marshal André Masséna, was finally back in the mix as well. He and Napoleon had their differences, both personal and political, but there was no denying that he was one of France's greatest soldiers. Another corps would be led by Marshal Lannes, one of Napoleon's earliest acolytes, and probably his best friend. In early spring, these forces were formally renamed, becoming the Grande Armée of Germany. That's a bit of a mouthful, so for the next series of episodes, I'll be referring to them simply as the Grande Armée. On paper, the overall commander was Napoleon's loyal chief of staff, Marshal Berthier. But it was generally understood that he was merely keeping the seat warm for the emperor himself. For the time being, Napoleon would remain in Paris. He had debated leaving for the Austrian frontier and assuming personal command over the Grande Armée, but had decided to wait until the war formally began. He was well aware that he was beginning to gain the reputation of a warmonger, and that his country, and even members of his own government, were growing weary of war. He wanted to ensure the Habsburgs were seen as the aggressors in the eyes of the world. His presence in Germany before hostilities began could be seen as provocative, give the impression that the Austrians were responding to an imminent French invasion, rather than vice versa. And so it would be Berthier holding the reins when the fighting started, a man with considerable talents, but no significant experience in personal command of large armies in the field. Berthier was far more comfortable poring over maps and crunching numbers in a dusty office than he was commanding soldiers in battle. Almost everyone saw war on the horizon. As we've discussed in the past few episodes, the tension had been building for months. Austria's armies were assembled along the borders, ready to advance. And yet, when the day came, it took the French by surprise. Bonaparte expected the first blow to come no earlier than April 15, 1809. In fact, Habsburg units began crossing the frontiers early on April 10th, nearly a week early. It was a true surprise attack. There was no formal declaration of war. Archduke Charles found this a bit ungentlemanly. When his army crossed into Bavaria, he had the courtesy to send a letter to Marshal Lefebvre, commander of the Bavarian forces, politely informing him that he was about to be attacked. Perhaps the Austrians would have been well advised to wait a little longer. Their early maneuvers were hampered by hard, relentless rain and near-freezing temperatures. Advancing through the Danube Valley, there were a lot of rivers and streams to cross. Between the rain and the spring thaw up in the mountains, all of these were running very high, and some were quite treacherous. Once the French and Austrian armies engaged, they would find the terrain quite confining. Almost all the action we'll be talking about for the remainder of this episode took place in a relatively small triangle of territory between the Danube and Isar rivers, roughly 75 kilometers by 75 kilometers by 106 kilometers. That's 46 miles by 46 miles by 75 miles for my fellow Americans. Not only were all the rivers running high, the combination of heavy rain and spring thaw had turned much of the open ground into lakes of mud, including some of the roads. This part of Bavaria was heavily forested as well, which made reconnaissance difficult, and limited mobility even further. The stage was set for a somewhat strange campaign, two armies slugging it out in a confined space, in which it was difficult to move quickly or get a clear picture of the enemy forces. As we've discussed, the French were surprised by the Austrian invasion, and in the early days of the war, confusion reigned within the imperial ranks. Napoleon had written orders to be implemented once the war broke out. Unfortunately for the French, these orders did not arrive at Marshal Berthier's headquarters until the third day of the war. Without word from Napoleon, Berthier had been forced to make his own plans, and they were deeply flawed. Not knowing exactly where the Austrians were or where Napoleon wanted the army concentrated, Berthier had kept his units relatively strung out. If Archduke Charles and his men moved quickly, they might split the Grande Armée in two. By the time Napoleon arrived at the front, there might already be a disaster underway. On April 15th, the main body of the Austrian army arrived outside their first objective, the city of Landshut. They needed to cross the Isar River. Landshut had two large bridges and was a significant transportation hub. They found the city defended by a division of Bavarian troops, who had blown up the bridges and taken up defensive positions along the western bank and in the hills outside the city. Clearly, the Bavarians were ready for a fight, but for some reason, the Austrians tried to negotiate passage over the river. As I mentioned earlier in this episode, the Habsburgs had hoped this campaign would take on the character of a German uprising against Napoleon. Perhaps they hoped their fellow German-speaking Bavarians might be ready to join the crusade. But perhaps unsurprisingly, the Bavarian division was not willing to roll out the welcome mat for an enemy army invading their country. They refused these overtures. The next day, the Austrians attacked. The Bavarians were badly outnumbered and stood no real chance of holding this position, but they resisted tenaciously, fighting no fewer than four rearguard actions as they fell back from Landshut. So far, the Bavarian army seemed just as willing to fight as their French counterparts. Fortunately for the Bavarians, at this stage, the Austrians were focused on speed, not on inflicting damage on the enemy. Archduke Charles believed there were greater prizes to be had further to the west. If the Austrian army moved fast enough, he thought there was a chance they might isolate the entire Bavarian military, plus all or part of Marshal Davout's corps, trap them on the wrong side of the Danube, and destroy them, or force them to surrender. After the Habsburg troops disengaged from the Bavarians, they sacked Landshut. They had outrun their supply train, they were hungry, and, like all armies of this era, most of them wanted to get drunk. So much for Germanic unity. Meanwhile, to the west, Napoleon was racing to the front. He had learned of the invasion early on April 12th, the second day of hostilities, spent the rest of the day settling his affairs in Paris, then left for Bavaria that evening. As the emperor passed through southern Germany, crowds lined the roads to get a glimpse of the great man's carriage. Apparently, they were not only curious, but largely supportive. An officer on Napoleon's staff described being greeted with cheers everywhere they passed. Bonaparte kept a grueling pace, getting on the road early every day and staying there until late in the night. However, he did make time to visit the capitals of all his German allies, to provide personal reassurances that the situation was under control. At every one of these stops, the emperor got a warm and deferential reception, exactly what he had been hoping for. The South German states, and even the South German people to a certain extent, remained steadfast, at least for the moment. Austrian dreams of some kind of pan-Germanic anti-Napoleon uprising were not materializing. Bonaparte reached army headquarters on April 17th and immediately assumed command. A Bavarian soldier would later recall, quote, "A universal cheer of joy announced the arrival of His Majesty, the Emperor of the French. As if touched by an electrical charge, the army was suddenly filled with joy and hope." End quote. Through a translator, Napoleon addressed the Bavarian army. Quote, "Bavarian soldiers, I stand before you not as the Emperor of the French, but as the protector of your country and of the Confederation of the Rhine. Bavarians, today you fight alone against the Austrians. Not a single Frenchman is in the first line. They are in reserve, and the enemy is unaware of their presence. I have complete faith in your bravery. I have already expanded the borders of your land. I see now that I have not yet gone far enough. I will make you so great that you will not need my protection in any future war with Austria. We march to Vienna, where we will punish it for all the evil it has caused your fatherland. They want to divide your nation and enroll you in the Austrian regiments. Bavarians, this war shall be the last you fight against your enemies. Attack them with the bayonet and destroy them." End quote. Some of the finer points may have been lost in translation, but the overall theme and sentiment were not. The Bavarians responded with a resounding cheer, and, judging from soldiers' memoirs, Napoleon's message really had resonated with his German allies. The first week of the war had been a strange one. Both sides had spent months planning and preparing for this moment, and yet both had stumbled out of the gate. I don't think this was incompetence. These were two of the best militaries in the world. It was difficult coordinating so many men in these conditions. Unrelenting rain, muddy roads, rivers running high, thick forests, and neither side fully aware of the disposition of the enemy. Both sides had to coordinate the movements of nearly 200,000 men in these difficult circumstances. To put that in perspective, the last time Napoleon and Archduke Charles had faced off, they were commanding armies around a quarter this size. Once Bonaparte took formal command over the Grande Armée, he began rethinking French strategy. With the enemy pushing hard to the west, he would concentrate two corps along their flank, then push for Lanzhut with its all-important bridges. This was the Achilles' heel of the Austrian advance. If the French were able to take the city, the Archduke's army would lose its only line of supply and communication back to Austria, and possibly even be trapped on the wrong side of the Isar River. Archduke Charles would have to respond. Napoleon hoped this would force him to pull some of his units away from the planned attack on Davout and Lefebvre. The French were in a dangerous position. Charles had seized the central position, and was poised to fall upon Davout and Lefebvre with superior numbers. There was still time to undo this, but only if the French moved fast. Napoleon's orders to Massena closed with this, quote, "There never was a stroke that demanded more energy and swiftness than this. Speed, activity, activity, all lies with you." End quote. It worked. Despite the rain and mud, Massena and Oudinot got their troops where they needed to be. Archduke Charles had no choice but to peel off an entire corps to counter this threat to Lanzhut. And so, when the Austrians were finally ready to launch the big attack against Davout on April 19th, they were only able to concentrate about 35,000 men, compared to over 40,000 French and Bavarian defenders. What came next is known to history as the Battle of Teugenhausen, but that's really more of a blanket term for an interconnected and somewhat confusing set of multiple relatively small engagements that all took place between units of Davout's corps and Archduke Charles's army on the banks of the Danube on April 19th, 1809. The French did indeed have their backs to the river, just as Archduke Charles had hoped. Even better, the Austrians had managed to capture a copy of Davout's orders to his subordinates, so they had a rough idea of the location and strength of every enemy unit. I think this is the only time this would be the case for either army during this phase of the war. However, this would be no easy fight. The Austrians were facing some of the best veteran French units, in good positions, with numerical superiority. The attack turned out to be a bit of an anticlimax. The Austrian troops were tired and hungry. They had been marching for over a week straight, through bitterly cold rain and mud. Their supply trains had been unable to follow, and food had become scarce. These engagements took place in bad weather, over a wide area of largely forested terrain. The staff officers of both sides found it impossible to get a good vantage point of the action. Nobody in either army had a clear view of these events until they were over. The Austrian leadership in particular seemed to struggle with the somewhat complex tactical situation, and their attacks were not well coordinated. In some places, they were able to force the French into fighting retreats. But Davout's overall position was never under serious threat. As always, France's Iron Marshal was brilliant fighting on the defensive. There was fierce combat in several places, but the outcome was never seriously in doubt. That evening, the heavy rain turned into a full-blown thunderstorm. Archduke Charles had no choice but to call off the attack. Both sides lost somewhere around 4,000 men. Meanwhile, further up the Danube, just past Davout's right flank, Marshal Lefebvre and the Bavarian army had received significant reinforcements, veteran French units from Marshal Lannes's corps, plus a large contingent of troops from the Kingdom of Württemberg. Napoleon ordered them to make a counterattack. This would put even more pressure on Archduke Charles's left flank, already threatened by the advance on Lanzhut. The offensive began the day after the action at Teugenhausen, April 20th. The Austrians were not aware of these reinforcements, and clearly were not expecting a counterattack. They were still in an offensive mindset, thinking of the enemy as far too vulnerable to do anything but react to their movements. That might have made sense a few days earlier, but the tables had begun to turn. In the wake of the defeat at Teugenhausen the previous day, Archduke Charles had ordered several units to bolster his exposed left flank. But it was too late. These orders had only just gone out when the French launched their attack. In some places, the advancing French and Allied German units encountered Austrian troops still in their march columns. In the midst of all this confusion, the Austrians made a mistake, leaving a large hole in their lines near a village called Bachel. Veteran French cavalry from Marshal Lannes' corps poured into the gap. Soon, Lannes had achieved a real breakthrough, pushing over 10 kilometers, or 7 miles, into the enemy rear. There was hard fighting in several locations, and the Austrians counterattacked where they could, but they were pushed back all along the line. This affair has gone down in history as the Battle of Abensberg, although just like the fighting the previous day, this is more of a blanket term for a series of related engagements that occurred across a relatively wide section of the front, rather than on a single battlefield. The French were finally stopped just before nightfall, but it had been a bad day for the Habsburg forces. Estimates vary, but they probably lost somewhere between 7 and 11,000 men. Perhaps as many as half of those were prisoners, mostly taken from units that were surprised and overwhelmed very quickly. An entire Austrian brigade had been completely destroyed. Perhaps worst of all, the French had now driven a wedge between one of the Austrian corps and the main body of their army. All this had been achieved at the cost of just under 1,000 French casualties. Although, when I say French casualties, I mean that only in the loosest sense. Napoleon's South German allies had borne the brunt of the fighting at Abensberg, and performed very well. The majority of those casualties were actually Bavarians and Württembergers. Archduke Charles was strangely absent during the Battle of Abensberg. Austrian army headquarters was not far from the action. They were apprised of all these events as they were unfolding, but the army's commander-in-chief didn't issue a single order during the fighting. Sources differ as to why. Some claim he suffered a seizure, then locked himself in his office while he recovered, to avoid alarming his staff and subordinates. The Archduke did suffer from epilepsy, so this is not implausible. However, it has also been argued that this was simply an excuse for poor leadership, that the Archduke was so shocked by his army's sudden change in fortune that he was paralyzed by indecision. Perhaps that is understandable to a degree. Things had changed very fast. Anybody would have experienced a bit of whiplash. Less than 48 hours earlier, the Austrians unquestionably had the initiative. They had seized and had been in the process of securing the central position between the two wings of the Grande Armée. Archduke Charles had believed he had a good chance of isolating and destroying Davout's corps and the Bavarian forces. But by nightfall on the 20th, the situation was drastically different. The two French victories at Teugenhausen and Abensberg, combined with the maneuver towards Landshut, had sucked all the momentum out of the Austrian offensive, and put their left flank and their lines of communication under serious threat. A few days earlier, Davout's corps and the Bavarian army under Lefebvre had seemed vulnerable, and perhaps in danger of total destruction. Now it was an Austrian corps under Baron Johann von Hiller that was isolated and vulnerable. The initiative had shifted to the French. The Archduke and his staff now had no choice but to shift to the defensive. Charles did not order a general retreat back to Austria, at least not yet, but he began repositioning his units further to the east. The Habsburg forces had been advancing every day for 2 weeks. Now they were drifting back the other direction. Now it was Napoleon who was urging his forces forward with all possible speed, hoping to trap the enemy in that rough triangle of land between the Isar and Danube rivers. The emperor was very pleased. He wrote, quote, "Yesterday and the day before are a second yena," end quote. He had good reason to be satisfied. His troops had inflicted perhaps as many as 15,000 losses on the enemy, and had changed the momentum of the campaign. But after Jena, the entire Prussian military had fallen apart. As of yet, there was no sign of a similar collapse among the Austrians. Now that the shoe was on the other foot, the French encountered many of the same problems that had hampered the Austrian advance. Poor weather, swollen rivers, and muddy roads. Napoleon knew this territory. He had fought a campaign in almost this exact area back in 1805, culminating in General Mock's surrender at Ulm. But that had been during autumn. The weather had been bad, but he hadn't had to contend with the spring thaws. This led him to underestimate the difficulty of crossing so many rivers and streams, and the level of mud his troops and supply trains would encounter. Trapping the main Austrian army just 2 weeks into the war would have been a masterstroke of unprecedented proportions, but the weather and terrain would not cooperate. And to their credit, the Austrians were far from beaten. They certainly weren't happy to be suddenly and unexpectedly in retreat, but they were still moving with urgency and still had plenty of fight left in them. The emperor's plan would prove far too ambitious. On the Austrian side, Archduke Charles refocused his right flank on the city of Regensburg, where there were bridges over the Danube, which his army might use to escape into Bohemia. The city was held by a French garrison, but the Austrians were able to overcome them relatively easily. Archduke Charles now had a viable escape route on both flanks. To the south, the Austrian left flank was racing for Landshut, with its bridges over the Isar River. The French were in hot pursuit. With the fall of Regensburg, the right flank of the Austrian army was reasonably secure, no longer in danger of being trapped with its back to the Danube. Archduke Charles felt confident enough to organize a counterattack. His right flank was being pursued by Marshal Davout's corps. The French were not yet aware that Regensburg had fallen. Napoleon believed they were racing to catch up to a demoralized enemy, cut off from their lines of supply, and desperately trying to avoid being trapped. In fact, the Habsburg troops were ready to fight, their lines of communication were safe, and they actually had a numerical advantage over their pursuers. The Austrians would attack Davout with a force of over 70,000 men, including a large contingent of cavalry. Davout's corps had been severely weakened. Several of his units had been temporarily reassigned to Lannes' corps for ease of movement. Davout's remaining units would be outnumbered by more than 2-1. The plan was to strike the French hard near a village called Ecmule, and give Napoleon a bloody nose before he had time to respond. They would pin Davout down with a frontal attack, led by the cavalry, then use their superior numbers to work around his flank, and hopefully envelop his command. A tried-and-true strategy, we've seen it countless times on this show. The fighting began early on April 22nd with a cavalry skirmish. It was bitterly cold and damp, everything had frosted over in the night, and a thick fog clung to the ground. As the Austrian cavalry made their preliminary attacks, and the rest of the Habsburg force got into position, it became clear to the Austrians something was amiss. Once Davout discovered he was under attack by a significant enemy force, he should have responded instantly to prevent his troops from being engulfed, falling back, redeploying, or both. But instead, the French more or less stayed put and prepared to engage the Austrians where they stood. Davout was not the type of general to make such an elementary mistake. So what was going on here? To their credit, the Austrians solved the mystery very quickly. Davout's behavior only made sense if he was expecting significant reinforcements. Napoleon had anticipated an engagement in this area. At around 2 o'clock that morning, the emperor himself had left camp with a significant number of troops from Lannes Corps, plus a large contingent of German allies. By the time the Austrians began their offensive, these forces had been on the road for hours and were expected around Eckmühl imminently. Sure enough, the Habsburg forces hadn't even finished deploying for battle when fresh enemy units began to appear along their left flank. This was supposed to be an Austrian attack on the French, culminating in a maneuver around the flank to attack the enemy rear. But instead, the Austrians would find themselves fighting on the defensive, with their own flank threatened. Yet another surprise reversal. Napoleon began his attack on the enemy left with an assault on the village of Eckmühl itself. This was a very strong position, lots of old stone buildings and garden walls, plus an old manor house that made a perfect fortress. This position was the key to the Austrian left. The French stood no hope of pushing into the enemy flank unless this village was taken. For this all-important mission, Napoleon chose several units from the Kingdom of Württemberg. The fighting was fierce. The Austrians were well entrenched and determined to hold them off. The Württembergers were thrown back twice before finally storming the village on their third attempt. There was bitter close-quarters fighting as the Württembergers cleared the village. In that manor house, the Austrians made them fight for every room. One of the Württembergers managed to seize the enemy battle flag. Once the town was secured, he personally delivered this trophy to Napoleon, who rewarded him with the Medal of the Legion of Honor. In the center, Davout launched an attack of his own, aiming to pin the Austrians down while the emperor pushed into their flank. Here, too, the Austrians resisted bitterly. The terrain was very difficult, mostly woods, dotted with the occasional small village, which the Habsburg defenders used to their advantage. The advance stalled. Not even the veteran French units of Third Corps could make progress under these conditions. Davout threw in reinforcements from the Bavarian army, and this second wave turned the tide. The white Habsburg lines began to drift backwards. The key to this part of the Austrian position was a fortified area in and around a village called Oberleichling, garrisoned by a unit of Hungarian grenadiers, some of the best troops in the Archduke's army. The Hungarians fought almost to the last man before finally being overcome by a joint French-Bavarian assault. Pressured on all sides, with every key position on the battlefield held by the French, Archduke Charles saw that victory was impossible and ordered a retreat. However, the fighting was far from over. The two opposing armies were now arranged roughly in an L shape, closely engaged all along the line. It would not be easy for the Austrians to extricate themselves from this position. Now it was time for the cavalry to take center stage. The Austrian horsemen rode out with orders to screen their forces from the enemy so the army could disengage. Napoleon sent out his cavalry to counter them. There was dramatic action all along the line as cavalry units charged and countercharged, fighting up close with sabers and pistols. These were some of the best horsemen in Europe. The fighting was fast and intense. The French eventually got the upper hand, but the Austrian cavalry achieved their objective. The rest of the army was able to fall back to a strong defensive position, where they could meet the French on more equal terms. Napoleon ordered his elite armored heavy cavalry, the cuirassiers, to charge this position. A German nobleman who witnessed the battle watched the cuirassiers ride into the fray. Quote, "I have never seen a more beautiful display. The sun sparkled on the brightly polished cuirasses, and the faces of the old warriors showed much courage and confidence in victory." End quote. The muddy terrain slowed the charge, and Austrian artillery fire felled many of the troopers, but the cuirassiers just kept coming. Apparently, some of the nearby French infantry stopped to cheer. The armored horsemen were met by the remains of the Austrian mounted units, and another fierce cavalry melee ensued. For a moment, it seemed the Habsburgs might overpower the cuirassiers, but then they were hit by a second wave of Bavarian cavalry, which drove the Austrian horsemen from the field. However, by now, any hope of actually trapping or destroying the Habsburg forces was lost. They had put enough distance between themselves and the French that they could begin retreating from the battlefield. The French harassed them for miles, but the battle was over. The Battle of Eckmühl had not lived up to Napoleon's loftiest ambitions, but it had been a considerable success for the French. The Habsburg counterattack had been stopped before it even began, at the cost of over 10,000 men. Napoleon's forces only lost about 3,000 men. Once again, France's South German allies had been right in the thick of the fighting, and once again, they had performed brilliantly. Before the war, the Austrians had hoped Napoleon's increasing reliance on foreign troops would work in their favor, that these units would be unenthusiastic, low quality, and maybe even unwilling to fight. The opening engagements of the war had dashed those hopes. Not only had the Bavarian and Württemberger troops held their own, they had actually distinguished themselves. They had seen a lot of the hardest fighting in the war so far, and had mostly come out on top. Every major engagement so far had been won by the Imperial forces, and South German troops had been instrumental in almost all these victories. After the battle, Napoleon held a council of war with all his senior staff officers and subordinates. This, 2 weeks into the war, was the first time the leadership of the Grande Armée had had the opportunity to actually meet and discuss strategy in person. On the Austrian side, Archduke Charles was so disheartened that he wrote to his brother, the Emperor, to suggest Austria sue for peace. Meanwhile, to the south, the Austrian left flank had won the race for Landshut. It had been very close. At one point, they had been forced to deploy a rearguard to fight off Marshal Massena's pursuing forces. But they had managed to get to the city first. They immediately began evacuating their troops over the Isar River. The French attacked the city as soon as they could. There was hard fighting, particularly around the bridges themselves, which were heavily fortified, and had to be taken by storm. One of Napoleon's closest personal aides, General Georges Mouton, led the attack which finally succeeded in overwhelming the last Austrian position on the west bank. It was another lopsided victory for the French. At Landshut, they lost just under 1,000 men, compared to roughly 8,000 Austrian casualties. However, yet again, this was only a partial victory. The majority of Baron von Hiller's corps had escaped across the river before the action even began. Still, it had been very close. In their haste, the Austrians had been forced to leave behind huge amounts of supplies and equipment. Everything from food and medical supplies to weapons and artillery. The French may have failed to catch the left flank of the enemy army, but they had captured most of its supply train. Napoleon now turned his attention to the last major river crossing in the region still controlled by the Austrians, Regensburg, in the far north of the area we've been discussing, where the right flank of the Austrian army was fleeing into Habsburg Bohemia. By now, the evacuation of Archduke Charles's army was well underway, but Bonaparte hoped there was still a chance to catch at least some of them if he could seize those bridges at Regensburg. This would not be a tactically sophisticated battle. Regensburg still had most of its old medieval walls. The Austrians were hunkered down in the buildings of the suburbs and along those walls. The only way to approach this position was by frontal assault. After a few preliminary skirmishes, Napoleon ordered an attack on the city's main gate, which was thrown back with heavy casualties. These defenses may have been designed before the invention of modern artillery, but they were formidable. Typically, an army of this era would have waited for their cannons to punch a hole in the defenses before making an attack, but the emperor was eager to take the city before Archduke Charles could finish the evacuation. He ordered another assault on the gate, but it too was thrown back with heavy casualties. With their backs to the river, the Austrians were fighting doggedly. The defenses were simply too strong to be taken by storm. Fortunately for the French, not long after the failure of this attack, a large crash could be heard further down the line. Part of the city walls had collapsed under French artillery fire. This was a real achievement. Normally, it took days to create a breach like this. Upon hearing the news, Napoleon rode forward to survey the damage. As he approached the breach, an Austrian cannon opened fire with canister shot, and the Emperor of the French fell. Everyone nearby must have felt their hearts sink into their stomachs. Ever since First Consul Bonaparte left to go on campaign all the way back in 1800, everyone in France had worried about this possibility. The entire political system revolved around Bonaparte. Love him or hate him, it was impossible to imagine what would become of the empire without him. Luckily for the French, Napoleon was only down for a moment. That Austrian cannon had been very far away. The emperor had been struck in the foot by a single round of canister shot, not much bigger than a musket ball, and by the time it reached him, it was mostly spent. He was hurt, but it hadn't even broken the skin. He immediately got back on his horse and began riding around the area, through the ranks of his soldiers, who raised a cheer as he passed. He wanted to demonstrate that he was unhurt and still in command. He knew how dark rumors could spread after incidents like this one, and how they might destroy the army's morale if they weren't nipped in the bud. Meanwhile, Marshal Lannes was organizing an assault on the breach. He called out for volunteers. This was typical in all the armies of this period. For an assault this dangerous, it was seen as better to rely on volunteers, enticed by their personal desire for glory and the promise of great rewards, rather than ordering men to go into the breach under the threat of punishment. The volunteers formed up and launched the assault, but were thrown back with heavy casualties. Once again, Marshal Lannes turned to his grenadier companies, specialists in assaults and close combat, and asked for volunteers to mount another attack. Seeing what had just happened to their comrades, no one stepped forward. Lannes decided to take matters into hand. He grabbed one of the scaling ladders himself and began to rush forward, shouting, quote, "I will show you that I was a grenadier before I was a marshal, and I am one still," end quote. His aides rushed after him and began to pull him back, but the gesture had the desired effect. Dozens of grenadiers stepped forward, and, led by Marshal Lannes' personal aides, they set out for the breach. Many of them fell, but they succeeded in storming the position. Some rushed into the city, while others began clearing the walls. More French units surged into the breach. With their main line of defense compromised, the defenders now stood little chance of repelling the French. But they fought on with great determination, making Napoleon's men fight for every street. The breach was stormed at some point in the late afternoon, but the last Austrian troops inside the city didn't surrender until well after nightfall. Once again, the French achieved a convincing victory, losing about 1,500 men compared to nearly 9,000 Austrian casualties. Somewhat confusingly, this engagement has gone down in history as the Battle of Ratisbon, which is an archaic name for Regensburg that was still in use in both French and English in the 19th century. Just like at Landshut, in their haste to get across the river, the Austrians had been forced to leave behind significant amounts of supplies and equipment. However, just like at Lanshut, they had managed to get almost all of their forces to safety before the French took the bridges. The next day, Napoleon addressed the army, quote, "Soldiers, you have justified all my expectations. You have supplemented your numbers by your bravery. You have gloriously marked the difference that exists between the soldiers of Caesar and the armed mobs of Xerxes. The enemy, intoxicated by their dishonest cabinet, appeared to no longer remember you. Their awakening has been quick. You have appeared to them more terrible than ever. Lately, they have invaded the territory of our allies. Lately, they presumed to carry the war into our country. Today, defeated and horrified, they flee in disorder. Within 1 month, we shall be in Vienna." End quote. Before this war began, it had been an open question whether or not the French army still enjoyed superiority over the Austrians. The setbacks in Spain and increasing reliance on new recruits and foreign allies may have diluted French strength, while on the other side, Archduke Charles's reforms seemed to have made the Habsburg military much more effective. Did the men of the Grande Armée still outclass the Austrians? In the opening weeks of the war, the answer seemed to be a resounding yes. The Austrians had gotten the drop on the French, and thus had started the campaign with a clear advantage. The subsequent events are a bit hard to follow, but the general trend is clear. In only a matter of days, Napoleon and the Grande Armée had turned the tables and dealt their enemies a series of major defeats in quick succession. The Austrians had started the last war by losing tens of thousands of men in an ill-advised offensive into southern Germany. Now, after all those drastic changes to their army's organization and doctrine, they had started this war by losing tens of thousands of men in an ill-advised offensive into southern Germany. You might be tempted to conclude that the Archduke's reform agenda had been a total failure. However, if you look at the performance of the Austrian army up close, I don't think it was as bad as it might seem at first glance. Although they had been soundly defeated, the Austrians had managed to escape with most of their forces intact and in good order. I don't think the Austrian army of 1805 would have managed that. If you could somehow replay this campaign with an unreformed, old-fashioned Austrian army instead of this new and improved version, I think it's very likely most, perhaps all of them, would have been trapped somewhere in that strip of land between the Danube and the Isar, and forced to surrender. The Habsburg forces were now in a very bad position. In retreat, demoralized, short on supplies and equipment, and split in two by the Danube River. But, with a little rest and resupply, they would be ready to challenge Napoleon again in the near future. The Emperor believed the Grande Armée would be in Vienna within a month. The way things were going, that was no empty boast. It really did look possible. But, with most of Archduke Charles's army still intact, the war was far from over. That's all for now. For those of you who are signed up on Patreon, I will be back to you in a few weeks with more bonus content. Make sure to get in your questions in the comment section of The Last Dispatch. As for the rest of you, I'll be back to you next month with the next phase of the War of the Fifth Coalition. Until then, thanks for listening.